looking at nothing.
Nada, 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 deep ways, nada.
Sometimes nothing is fun.
Nothing from nothing is nothing.
It ain't nothing but a nothing, nothing. Welcome to the Darker Side Podcast, where we delve into the darker side of our existences. The morbid, the macabre, the spooky, and the absurd are all fair games as we discuss murder, UFOs, cryptids, sometimes creepypasta, the paranormal, and the dark depravity of the human soul. I am David, and with me today is Herman. We are sans forest today.
Yeah, we're out of the forest.
Yeah, we're no longer lost in that forest.
Sadly, we're no longer in the shade of the forest.
Yes, exactly. But yeah, Forrest had some prior engagements, and today it's just going to be me and German. Me and the German Herman.
The Germans.
The German. Me and the German.
The Germans are coming.
Yeah. Talking at you today. Today we don't have any sponsors, but we do ask you to go check out the DCP Network and all of our other podcasts, Glit. F, Getting Lost Glyph. In the Forest.
Yeah, check that out. Forest killing it with that thing.
Yeah, and the Darker Side Pod, the DCP Network. So check all those things out. Please rate and love us as you guys do. Right now, we're going to get into our news stories. Herman, what do you got for a news story for us today, bro? All
right, well, this is from July 23rd from UPI. That is the United Press International Incorporated, so you know it's owned by the government.
Of course.
Google Translate glitch changes gibberish to prophecy.
How?
I'm going to tell you.
Okay, excellent.
So the article goes thus. Google's online translation tools are setting internet conspiracy theorists ablaze after a glitch was discovered that turns gibberish into biblical prophecies.
Excellent.
Back at it. The Translate glitch, which was popularized by posts on Reddit, can be accessed by typing in the English word dog 18 times and telling the tool to translate the text from Maori. Quote, the doomsday clock is 3 minutes at 12, and we're experiencing characters and a dramatic development in the world, which indicate that we are increasingly approaching the end times and Jesus' return, the translated text reads.
Wow.
Yeah.
Very interesting.
So you type dog 18 times, ask it to translate to Maori, and you get the doomsday clock is at 3 minutes to 12, and we're experiencing characters and dramatic developments in the world.
Wow. Maori as in like the island tongue?
Yeah.
Interesting.
Yeah.
Wow. And that's just a glitch in the Google Translate.
Is it a glitch, David?
I'm not sure.
Is it a glitch?
Is it the ghost in the machine? Is it the Matrix, the Godhead, the figure? Interesting.
Yeah, so... there's another one where they put, they typed Donald Trump, Donald Trump, Donald Trump, but they did do N-A-L space N-A-L-D, T-R-U space M-P over and over again, and then translated it from Somali, causing the English translated to read, do not do this anymore.
Oh, it's weird. It's kind of like, I gave you the message, don't translate this any longer. You already got the message.
These are fantastic. So there's another one where typing the word goo 13 times and asking it to translate it from Somali creates the translation, cut off the penis into pieces, cut it into pieces. Which I don't know is a biblical prophecy, but...
Sounds kind of like a Papa Roach song, if you ask me.
Exactly.
Cut my penis into pieces.
Done it. Dun it.
This is my last result.
Dun it.
Yeah.
Dun it. Dun it. Oh man, that's fantastic. So yeah, there's a whole host of those, and that's Google letting us know how planet Earth is actually doing.
Well, thank you, Google.
Yeah. This is the machines taking over, Dave.
Yeah, they're slowly going to be doing that to us, and we are letting them. We are enabling them by creating them.
Just remember on that day in 1997, if you're not wearing sunblock 2 million, you're going to have a real bad day. Get it?
Oh, yeah. I mean, if only we could go back to 1997 and change everything. Oh, they're doing a reboot with her involved. That's Sarah Connor, by the way.
Oh, Linda Hamilton is Sarah Connor?
Yeah.
I am so down.
Yeah, exactly.
Salisbury, Maryland's own Linda Hamilton.
Oh, beautiful.
And her sister. So when they had the flashbacks with her looking, you know, young and not like she was chiseled out of solid rock.
Right.
They used her sister because her sister was like a librarian in the Salisbury schools or something like that. I'm screwing this up, but she had sort of a normal job her job wasn't to work out and look like a badass for a movie. So they would flash to her sister because they look so much alike.
That's very cool.
A little fun fact.
That's awesome. Well, thank you for that wonderful news story about the machines. Again, one of many machines about to take over the planet.
You could. There's an argument to be made that Google has taken over the planet. I would ask anyone to use the internet today without using Google at all. Any of their products. Good luck.
All right. Well, I got a news story here from BuzzFeed. It's kind of funny and related to a cryptid that we had talked about a little while ago. It says politician tweeted about Bigfoot erotica, and everyone was like, "What the fuck." Bigfoot porn being, quote, Bigfoot porn being an actual topic of political discussion is my absolute favorite thing to happen in 2018. This is amazing, end quote. This is brought to you us by Michelle Border Van Dyke, July 30th of 2018.
I thought for a hot moment you were going to say Michelle Obama. I was like, she's doing good things.
Yeah, no. It says, hello there. I see you have come to learn more about Bigfoot erotica because somehow that's what people are talking about. So let's see if we can explain how we all got there. On Sunday night, Leslie Cockburn, a Democrat running for the U.S. House seat in Virginia, shared a tweet with a screenshot supposedly taken from her Republican opponent's Instagram Instagram account. The tweet showed a Bigfoot with his private parts censored by a very long black box.
Sorry, God.
Denver Riggleman and Cockburn are running against...
I'm sorry. You've got Riggleman and Cockburn.
Riggleman and Cockburn are running against each other for Virginia's 5th congressional district, which includes the city of Charlottesville. But... No, this is... Cockburn, who is a journalist and author, is a first-time candidate who won the Democratic Party's nomination in the 2018 race. Riggleman is a distillery owner and former Air Force intelligence officer who ran for governor in 2017 and has never held a seat in public office. The congressional seat became available after Republican Rob Tom Garrett announced that he would not seek re-election. Again, this district includes Charlottesville, the site of last year's Unite the Right White Right Alley. Al Rally.
Wow, that was an interesting choice of Right Alley.
Right, yeah, the right white supremacist rally that turned deadly last year. Let's see here. In her tweet Sunday, Cockburn accused Riggleman of campaigning with a white supremacist and also of being a devotee of Bigfoot erotica.
I mean, who isn't
it? Her Twitter picture said, "My opponent, Denver Riggleman, running mate of Corey Stewart, was caught on camera campaigning with a white supremacist. Now he has been exposed as a devotee of Bigfoot erotica. This is not what we need on Capitol Hill." Oh man! And actually, what happened after this is, and I'm not going to get too much in. You guys can check this out. We'll have the link for it, and it gets quite funny, especially with what the internet and Twitter can do. But the Twitter world went fucking batshit crazy with this, as they normally do, creating meme after meme, wonderful comments and quotes, and they just ran nuts with it. And it is actually a subject of talk in the 2018 election year.
That's fascinating. What's interesting, and I believe, and correct me if I'm wrong out there, people, but I believe it's Rule 72 of the internet says, if it exists, it exists on the internet in porn.
Yeah.
You can find two Star Wars AT-ATs having coitus on the internet in a wonderful video.
There, Bigfoot erotica absolutely exists. That it is a thing. It is a very small subculture of people, but it exists. Why not? He's a big, hairy, lovable guy from another dimension. He needs love.
Everybody needs love.
Everybody needs love, John.
So, you want to do one more?
We could do one more. Yeah, if John's got another, Herman's got another news story here for us. We're gonna trip it up for you guys today.
It's a short one, and you know Forrest isn't here, so I figure I'll do Forrest's story.
Sweet.
This one's really short. What are the odds of being a serial killer's victim? Now, this is given to you by casino.org, who makes a book. So my theory is they are spot on with the odds.
Of course.
So they go through a long sort of description, you know, what is a serial killer, how do they kill, all that kind of garbage, who they kill. But really, the meat and potatoes of the serial killing is that with a homicide, the homicide rate of 3.9 per 100,000, you've got only a 0.00039% chance of being a serial killer's victim.
So those are really, really low odds. Or high odds?
Those are low odds. Those are not gambler's odds. So they actually spent the time to figure out, based on the number of homicides that are actual serial killers, which is
population and
3.9 per 100,000.
That's crazy.
Yeah.
Wow.
You have a 0.000.
I wonder if there's an illegal betting ring for serial killer kills, and who knows? People bet on anything.
You can bet on absolutely anything.
And why not leave it to Vegas? Is it Vegas or Atlantic City?
It's got to be Vegas.
Vegas. Yes. Leave it to Vegas to put the odds on that, right?
Yeah, I mean, people bet on the coin toss for the Super Bowl. There's a huge, huge gambling community for that.
Well, it's a 50-50 chance. It's just basically like rolling red or black on roulette.
Yeah.
You know? I think I hit 17 times in a row one day at the casino.
Oh, wow.
Yeah.
I've never played roulette.
Yeah, you pay 25, you get 50, you know, you just take that 150, I mean that 125 and double it up, keep doubling it up.
Huh.
It was fun. I lost it that day, though. So that's what gambling does. That's what they want from you. That reminds me of I saw a quick article just to discuss a little bit longer. It said, study finds that people who like dark chocolate and black coffee are psychopaths.
I love dark chocolate and black coffee.
I was gonna flag you, but I didn't want to put it out there. But I absolutely knew that you were a lover of dark chocolate and coffee. And I'm like, I know Herman. I know he's not a psychopath. So I don't know. Maybe you're one of those rare occasions of people who don't like that aren't psychopathic. But fuck that study anyway.
That's good. That's junk science.
Yeah. Or maybe, who knows? But yeah, I mean, What a dumb little study that was.
Oh my God, that's funny. I love that. You should send that to me.
I will. I'll find it again and then I'll send it over to you. All right, guys. Well, that was the news stories for today. Right now, we are going to go to Creepy Pasta Corner.
Some freaky farfalle.
Freaky farfalle. So today's creepy pasta is called The Chair. I was never at all superstitious. From what I can remember, I always looked at life from a practical sense. I was always in the present. I liked my particularity and realism. It was my favorite part of myself. I had a passion for interior design and home furnishing. I liked to think of myself as an artist. When I was not at work, I would often browse the internet. I had my own blog. I posted photos of my home and interior design, and some of the artwork and interior designs my friends made. We would often collaborate on home projects. We were obsessed with it. One day I went to my local IKEA to get some inspiration for home project. I often went to IKEA to browse. I enjoyed getting lost in the endless hallways and rooms, each with a different setup to stimulate my imagination. I often imagined what a furniture piece would look like in my home. Although I didn't have much money and it would be cheaper just to make one, I came across something very odd during my last visit to IKEA. It was nothing much to look at. It was a vintage high back chair with a wooden frame, dull white cushions on the seat in the back. This was odd because IKEA didn't sell chairs like this. As for me, I had a more modern taste. I never made or bought anything like this. I was curious and decided to get a closer look. It had a label, but it was not specific in the least. It read the chair. No logo, no brand, no price, nothing but the chair.
So not the Sporkersborg?
No, not some clever chair. Swedish name. Yeah, exactly. It did not look like it was very comfortable, but I was intrigued and decided to sit anyway. It was the most comfortable chair I'd ever sat on in my life. I felt myself slowly mold into the chair despite this being unusual, since it was only a small wooden chair with sewn-on cushions. I could feel my body growing more and more tired. I didn't want to fall asleep in the middle of the store, so I tried to get up. My body wouldn't let me. My eyelids were beginning to close. I forced them open, but it was useless. I called for some assistance, but no one answered. In fact, no one seemed to notice me at all. I made another attempt to wheel my tired body out of the chair. My arms began to shake as I pushed on the arms rest on the chair. I managed the strength to lift my body a few inches off the chair. My fatigue got the best of me, and I slammed down on the chair. We're going to stop here for a second. I just want to let you guys know that this is the beauty of creepypasta. Horrible sentence structures, horrible timing. This is one of my favorite things about creepypasta.
I don't understand why the word painting came into it.
Exactly.
The chair painting.
Right.
Oh, he's behind the stairs.
All right, back to our scheduled story. I tried everything possible to keep myself awake, but my eyes began to close without me even noticing.
Washing machine.
I caught myself just in time. My eyes closed for only a millisecond, but when I opened my eyes again, I saw that the only people left were the security guards and the janitors. They still paid no attention to me. I turned to gaze out the window. I saw the moon and the empty parking lot. It was nighttime, and the store was closed. I tried again to get myself out of the chair. I could not move. I screamed at the top of my lungs, which at this point was just a quiet cry. The janitor that was mopping the floor right next to me should have been able to hear me, but he remained unaware of my existence. The louder I screamed, the more I tried, I became, the more tired I became, and I could feel my eyes closing again. There was nothing I could do. This time I felt it like more time passed than a millisecond, maybe a minute or two, but when I woke, there was no one. I looked around. All the furniture items had vanished, apart from the chair I was sitting on. It was just a big empty warehouse. I looked out the window. The moon, the sky, and the parking lot had gone. My view was pitch black. It looked as if the windows were blocked out. At this point, I couldn't scream. I could barely move my mouth. I noticed a tingling in my lower back. I couldn't do anything but sit there in utter discomfort. I didn't want to close my eyes again. The discomfort only got worse. The tingling was felt under my eyes and all through my back. My shirt felt as if it was attaching itself to my skin. My eyes would not close now. The discomfort drew on and on and on until finally I drifted to sleep once again. I awoke to find that all the lights had gone out. I felt like I was being watched. I could no longer turn my head. A shiver ran down my spine, or up my spine, and crawled into my brain. That's a Misfits reference, everybody.
I think it is.
I had woke to find all the lights had gone out. I felt like I was being watched. I could no longer turn my head. A shiver ran down my spine and through my entire body. My mind ran rampant. I could not rationalize this utter terror was the only thing running through my head. I heard small scampering movements. I saw in the darkness what looked like a man standing there and staring at me. What was going on? Last time I fell asleep, I was not even aware I had drifted off consciousness. But when I woke up, I found IKEA structure crumbling. The walls and the floor had faded to a dirt yellow. There were various cracks and holes in the building. And out the window was the sun blaring at what seemed like triple what it normally emitted. There were no items on display. There were a few shopping carts. They were knocked over and gathering dust. I sat there in the chair for what seemed like weeks. There was no pain, but I knew I was being tortured. There was all kinds of torment around, all kinds of torment after all. I could not move. I could not turn my head. I was completely paralyzed. The only thing I could feel were the shivers and the increasing pressures. I wanted to fall asleep, but I could not. I wanted to get out of the chair, but I could not. I sat there. My mind was racing. My body lay completely motionless. The utter lack of motion was torture enough. And by the second, it just got more uncomfortable and more stiff. Eventually, after what felt like months, I managed to make a slight head turn. It turned into shaking. I could feel my body getting heavier, and I felt the wooden legs in the chairs shaking. They began to crack, and after about 3 hours of uncontrollable shaking, the chair broke. My eyes closed for an instant, and when I opened, I found that I was back at the store. In the very instant I had sat on the chair, everyone was staring at me. The chair lay there. Its four legs snapped off, and the back was cracked. I could move again, and I could see an irritated young employee approaching me. "Excuse me, sir, you're going to have to pay for that," he told me. Yes, of course, I stammered. "Look at the tag again." This time it had read, "Late 19th century French Art Nouveau Lily White Armchair, $2,250. I went to the counter and paid with my credit card. I asked if I could throw the chair out for me. I told him that since it was broken, I had no use for it. He agreed. I raced out of the store, and I didn't look back. I abandoned my car. I walked. I did not want to sit down at all. I tried my best to make sense of that I had just been through. It was too vivid for a dream, yet once I broke the chair, it was like nothing had happened. I found myself shaking still and decided to stop for some chamomile tea for my nerves.
Of course.
Of course. Not like 17 beers and like...
Like a 5 Boilermakers.
Yeah, exactly.
Shot and a brew, Shelly. Keep them coming.
But hey...
Chamomile tea, please.
Chamomile will definitely do that for you.
I guess.
I wanted to call my friends and tell them everything I had been through, but I knew they wouldn't believe me. I knew of sleep paralysis. I researched the symptoms. They matched what I felt during the time in the chair, but there was nothing on the internet to explain the eyes nor the changes in landscape between sleeps. I had my car towed. I lived relatively far away. It was a long walk. I was beginning to tire out, but the time I reached my neighborhood, it was dark out. I wanted to believe that it wasn't true. I wanted to rationalize, but that was no longer possible. I came across my friend Simon's house and decided to go in for a visit. Simon let me stay at his place for the night. I told him that my car slid into a ditch and had to be towed, and that I was too tired to walk any further. Simon advised me to sit down, but I had refused. Simon said he had to run to the store to buy some wood for a project. I did not want to be left alone, but I told myself it would be fine. I did not sit down at all. I pulled out my computer and decided to check my blog. I did not know what I was expecting, but I always like to check. I saw a post I never made before. It was a photo of the chair. You know, the one which I mean. There was a caption. "This antique French armchair is so cozy you won't ever want to get up. You'll be so comfortable, you'll lose track of time." I froze up, closed the lid of my laptop, and decided to go to bed. I went upstairs. Again, creepypasta. So good. I went upstairs to the guest room. And I was still quiet. I was still quite paranoid and afraid to rest, but I was growing more tired by the second, and maybe some rest would do me some good. The guest room didn't have a bed. All it had was a vintage high-backed chair with wooden frame, dull white cushions, and a seat in the back. I was too tired to resist.
Pasta!
That is where I am now. It has been 3 days, though time is hard to tell. Simon probably thought I had left and returned to my house as he came into my new room. Many times now, he hasn't noticed me once. I know I will fall asleep soon. I can feel myself growing more and more tired every time I press a key. But I have to get my message across. You never know what can happen in life. You never know what to trust. If you take a seat, you may never get back up. That was written by credited to a Colican Radio.
Yeah, I can't do any better than Colican Radio. So,
Colican Radio, very interesting story, my friend. That's creepypasta for you, though. I went to sleep. I was in chair. Thank you, creepypasta. All right, guys, that was Creepypasta Corner. We are now going to dive deeper into the darker side.
It was also the sound of Dave lowering his hat for a second.
Very cool.
Yeah, it's nice. Getting some reality, folks.
Diving deeper into the darker side. UFO edition, 1974, Chihuahua, Mexico UFO crash. Part 2.
Part 2 of Chihuahua.
Of Chihuahua.
So when last we spoke, I said, and that's the end of part 1.
So true.
So in the last episode, In the last episode, the Mexican military had attempted to recover an aircraft of unknown origin and indeed of unknown propulsion in the Chihuahua Desert. The authors of Mexico's Roswell, the Chihuahua UFO crash, suggest that because of this fact, the decision to recover the craft was impromptu, and in hindsight, hindsight being what it is, it was slightly ill-advised.
Right.
They note that UFO researchers will tell you that the U.S. carries out most of the recovery worldwide due to their vast experience in dealing with UFOs. As the U.S. has been monitoring this particular situation very closely and had already gathered together the men and vehicles necessary, naturally, they had only one option. Go in and extract the UFO and bring it back to America.
As what America does, we go in, get what we want, come out. Boom.
Pew, pew. America.
Yeah.
Yeah.
Especially in, like, UFO intelligence.
Right, right. Whiskey for my men, beer for my horses.
Exactly.
So, while this might seem a bit hasty, this is a UFO that was capable of...
It's very cool kind of German.
Yeah. This is a UFO that was capable of killing 24 soldiers by leaking its unknown contents. And it did happen 30 miles south of the U.S. border. So, though misguided to say the least, the U.S. recovery is not entirely unreasonable. We're going in, boys, whether Mexico wants us or not. America.
America. Fuck yeah, as Forrest would say.
Oh yeah, thanks. Miss you, Forrest.
We were filleted for Forrest. I gotta get those in.
Yeah, please do. On this subject, the book offers this quote from UFO researcher B.J. Booth.
B.J.
Yeah. I love the B.J. Booth. You gotta pay a little extra for that kind of action, but man, is it worth it.
Exactly.
The anonymity really is what anyway. Yeah, yeah. B.J. says... All of the things that BJ says they, the U.S., can always find a way to enter foreign territory and justify it with the American people. However, dealing with the Mexican government would have necessitated them using the ploy of assistance and life-saving helping hands to go into Mexico. End quote.
Huh. Yeah, sure.
Yeah, we love the helping hand of friendship and brotherly love. Regardless, at 4:53 p.m. on Monday, August 26, 1974, the U.S. scrambled their UFO recovery team mere hours after Mexico had sent theirs. The recovery effort from the U.S. was a little more purposeful. Having the advantage of learning from the mistakes of the past, the U.S. scrambled four helicopters that had been prepped at the airbase in El Paso for this purpose. Three Hueys capable of carrying 14 people, and one Sikorsky Sea Stallion capable of carrying 7 tons of cargo or 55 passengers.
Wow.
Yeah, the Sikorsky's cool, man. I was looking up, I got sort of sidetracked while I was doing
the
research.
Is that like your Aliens 2, like, transport ship?
Dude, it's like a helicopter school bus tractor trailer. It's giant. It is so cool.
It's capable of holding at least 55 troops. Oh, they're the ones with the double, the quadruple wing, quadruple propellers, right?
Man, that's a good point. I think the Sea King has the four.
Okay.
The Sikorsky, wow, it's actually a tongue twister. The Sikorsky Sea Stallion is traditional helicopter in shape, but it is just a behemoth.
Oh, okay, yeah, I know exactly. Yeah.
Yeah, it's.
It's a workhorse.
Yeah, it's. If it's capable of carrying 7 tons of cargo, what can you send out of the helicopter is another question.
Exactly.
Anyway, so when the choppers arrived on the scene, they saw, you know, what was there firsthand. It was as if the whole convoy was frozen in place. The bodies of the two soldiers were clearly visible in the sand near their jeeps. And what would cause trained soldiers to stop and flee their vehicles on foot? Now, no one really goes into this, but what would? Why would a trained soldier moving an object undercover from one place to another, why would they get out?
Right, all of a sudden just stop and get out running. Or just get out of there. Why?
Yeah, presumably you leave a vehicle to escape the situation, but why would you leave a vehicle on foot to escape a situation when you're in something that could escape by its very nature?
Right, it's a vehicle.
No one really goes into this, but this haunted me. Why would two people get out of the vehicle they're driving? And why was it only two?
Right. That is so weird. Yeah, I have no honest theory behind this except for they were compelled through some other means, whether it be poison, some sort of controlling entity.
So they knew they were dying and they were going nuts.
Right.
I buy that.
Yeah. I mean, that's technically where I was going with that. But other than that, no. Especially if you're a military personnel, you follow your protocol and project orders till you get to the end.
Exactly.
Deliver that cargo to home base. But they didn't. They stopped for
they
no
stopped,
apparent reason.
Jumped out of the vehicles and died in the sand.
Right. Fucking crazy.
So anyway, back to the U.S. The helicopters filled with trained U.S. soldiers in chemical prevention gear touched down on the desert floor and began the land portion of the carefully planned extraction mission. The goal was to recover an extraterrestrial material, neutralize contamination, and eliminate all traces of a crash and get back to the U.S.
So basically a sweep-up, mop-up job?
Yeah, it's almost like a surgical strike on Mexican soldiers. Mexican soil.
Exactly.
It's
clever.
Yeah. Again,
clever.
If
well thought out.
If we can trust a report that was sent to two UFO researchers. When the team began exploring the site, they noted that all of the soldiers were dead, and the cause could not be determined. They were simply slumped over in their vehicles. According to Torres and Uriati, the Deneb report, which is the name of the report that I couldn't think of in the last episode,
right,
stated, quote, "Unfortunately, what caused the deaths of the Mexican recovery team is not known. Speculation ranges from a chemical released from the UFO as a result of the damage to a microbial agent. There are no indications of death or illness by any of the members of the U.S. recovery team."
Now, were they the? Is there any word on the type of gear that the American team might have? Would they have protective suits on, breathers, and things like that?
They had the whole complement.
Like, they knew what they were getting into.
They've done this before.
Chemical, biological, everybody was protected when they went in there. Like the old ET.
Correct, yeah.
Right.
Yeah, but
protocol.
The 1974 version of that. And they, to be fair, we have, if you believe in this sort of thing, we have the knowledge we gained in Roswell.
And even earlier.
And earlier.
Exactly.
And we know that people died. What did they die from? We don't know, but we know that there are chemical weapons and biological agents, and we have the tools and the talent to prevent that stuff.
Yeah, and we also have the knowledge at this point from Kecksburg. We have the knowledge from Rendlesham. We have all of this knowledge at that point. Because this is in the 70s, that was back in the 50s and 60s.
Yeah, no, I think you're right. So one of the sad things about this is that there was no actual attempt by the recovery team to identify the cause of death.
Well, they were in there to get it, sweep it up, and get out. And again, that's Mexico's problem.
Yeah, and I mean, this is a missed opportunity, but the U.S. has already violated enough rules.
Right.
Why not simply grab a couple of bodies and bring them back to El Paso, though? Seriously.
For testing.
You've broken enough rules.
Right.
Bring a couple of bodies.
What are a couple
of
extra missing people?
Right.
Right.
As time was no doubt short, the Americans suspended the craft from the Sea Stallion, wrapped in the same tarp that the Mexicans had covered it in when loading it onto their truck. It was estimated to weigh about 1,500 pounds, which is well below the multiple ton carrying capacity of that chopper.
1,500 pounds? And what was the original dynamic, like size of the craft?
16 feet by 5 feet.
I mean, that's still a pretty decent sized craft for only being 1,500 pounds.
It's actually pretty light, right? I mean, think of your car.
And it's a space travel, and it's a ship that could potentially either go underground or into outer space.
Yeah, I mean, if you believe the story, it's at least capable of going a couple thousand miles an hour at 75,000 feet.
Right, which is nuts. Yeah, that's crazy, though.
Once the craft was gone, so once the craft was loaded up on the Sikorsky and shipped out towards the U.S., the American soldiers loaded the bodies of their Mexican counterparts onto the trucks.
Huh.
They drove the vehicles into a tight formation. Then the Americans neutralized any threat. The original report notes that the Americans used, quote, high explosives, end quote. The authors of this book surmise that those explosives could have been an MK-54, special atomic demolition munition.
Wow.
You know, a briefcase nuke capable of delivering 10 tons to 1 kiloton of explosive force and lots of heat. This was a likely choice, given the need to cleanse the area of any contaminants.
Well, I mean, again, we don't know what it is. I mean, speculation here, there, everywhere. this could be a completely foreign compound that we could never even understand.
Yeah, the beauty of a fission reaction is that it's pretty good at eliminating any biological and most chemical contaminants.
Exactly.
Creates some of its own, for sure, yeah, but right. We know what those are.
Right.
And anyway, there's uranium in them thar hills, so yeah, no harm, no foul, I guess.
Except for that mini crater.
Yeah.
That's left.
Unless you're wondering about the logic of blowing up a nuclear device on somebody else's soil.
Right, so that's my question. A question arises, and I'm sure many questions arise at this point. How is this not seen as an active act of war?
I have no idea.
They have to have some sort of seismological company, you know, and to come upon, like, oh, didn't we send a group of people there, and now there's this giant hole in the Mexican desert?
I feel like if you touch off a nuclear weapon, there would be some signs that you might be able to pick up. Yeah, especially like, considering that...
Seismology-wise, a radiation spike in a certain area.
Yeah, and given that this is 30 miles from the U.S. border and Coyome is 50 miles from the U.S. border, we're talking 20 miles...
south.
As the crow flies
right.
To the town where they sent the military from. So where's the Mexican military during all of this?
Right, and where did the Mexican government come into play here?
But if I had to speculate, and I might as well... my guess is the handshake deals finally worked.
Okay.
You lost a bunch of soldiers. We're coming in. We're going to clean this up. Don't ask any questions. Leave us the hell alone.
So
it had to have been.
So they had to have been communicating with the Mexican government at that point that you have a contaminated area here, possibly, and we need to eliminate the threat at all costs.
Yeah, 30 miles from the U.S. border, we're involved now.
Right.
And my guess is that the history that was already there from all those rockets.
And if this is a biological thing... which, again, they didn't do any testing.
None.
If this is a biological thing, this could easily affect multiple persons.
Well, they didn't test where they should have. They didn't test the people.
Right.
So after blowing up the scene of the crime, as it were, the team boarded the choppers. They didn't blow it up with themselves there, I guess is the point that I'm having. So I talk about how they conceivably could use this high explosive, but the team can't blow up a high explosive while they're sitting there.
Right.
So presumably a bunch of techs set a timer, they hopped into some choppers, and away they went. At 5:46 p.m., the helicopters lifted off and headed back towards Texas. As they flew off, the timer counted down to zero, and a nuclear explosion rocked the desert in Mexico, sending a cloud high into the sky.
And if there wasn't an agreement between both governments at this point, each one of those could cover that up really fast.
Yeah, and it was low yield, so, I mean, the effects
right.
would be very localized.
Right.
It's not these aren't designed to, you know, scorch. It's designed to scorch the earth, but only in a small area.
Yeah, not Nagasaki or any of those types of explosions.
Yeah, we're talking a 10-ton explosion.
Right.
And when you talk about Hiroshima and Nagasaki, you have to start talking in megatons.
Right.
So understand that the team of American soldiers and G-men had a potentially hazardous UFO dangling from cables on a helicopter in a foreign country where they had just set off a small nuclear explosion. So they couldn't exactly fly anywhere that they pleased. They proceeded tight over the mountains to a previously determined location in the remote and rugged Davis Mountains in Texas.
Which are some very remote mountains in Texas.
Yeah, they actually leased land from a guy who just like happened to own a mountain. They're like, let me, here's money, shut up and...
take it.
Take your wife to the Bahamas for
exactly.
a week.
Exactly.
They landed at approximately 7 p.m. on August 26, 1974. This is within 21 hours from when it was first sighted.
Oh, wow. So, I mean, this is quick operations.
Yeah, it's pretty snappy, isn't it?
Right.
I don't know how you could do this without the cooperation of the Mexican government. I really don't. The helicopters would have been seen. The explosion certainly would have been seen. My conjecture and my theory would be that
we've got your back. We're helping you out in this situation.
Yeah, they turned that blind eye. They're like, you know, this is, you guys deal with it. We blew it.
Right.
The Davis Mountains, where they took this thing, are in a very remote location, as Dave said, and it's sort of perfect to defend against any onlookers. The land was said to have been leased by the government from a private landowner. For 7 hours, soldiers waited by the craft. They just tensely waited for the next phase of their mission. And how tense was that?
Well, especially even if you are in a suit, protected otherwise with breathers, etc., it's still very intense.
Yeah, you've got a dangling object that killed 24 Mexican soldiers. You just blew up a nuclear weapon on foreign soil, flew this dangling thing from a ship, landed it, and are hiding it from the American people. That's a ticking time bomb.
Yeah. Yeah, for sure.
So at 2 a.m., the package was handed off to a team whose duty it would be to investigate the object. Now, here's where this starts to actually get kind of fun. So the UFO was loaded onto trucks and tarped, of course, and it was sent to a top secret location.
Top secret, you say?
Top secret. Where would you send this thing?
Where are we?
Texas.
New Mexico?
No. That would make sense.
Right.
They packaged it and drove it over the street to Atlanta, Georgia, to the CDC.
Are you shitting me? That's crazy. That makes even more sense. Why not? Just go straight to the CDC. So what, they basically covered it up, put it on a flatbed. Or did they fly it there?
They flatbedded it to the CDC, taking back roads the whole way. You can't just rock this thing down I-10.
No.
Which I-10 will take you from Texas to Atlanta directly straight.
But no, I mean, it would definitely have to have been back roads. And it probably just looked like some sort of construction, wide load, trying to stay off the highways type of thing.
So what's interesting about this at this point is it gets to the CDC.
And that's where the road ends?
And then the trail is cold.
Interesting.
Yeah. So one thing about this incident that they bring up in the book and that I was trying to find out is if this craft was intelligently flown by a peoples and it crash landed, where are the bodies?
Right. Especially if it was in such great structural condition at the time of the crash. I mean, like they said, it barely had a mark except for that one hole where this supposed contaminant was coming from. Where were the drivers? Was this a drone, or were there people in, or not, you know, people but aliens or
a peoples?
Right, a person. Yeah.
So here's an interesting one. In the book, they talk about a UFO researcher from Phoenix, Arizona. His name is Robert Dean. And he has in the book says this, in his possession, a photograph of a small gray alien. You know, the grays, big eyes, big head, that sort of thing. That he was told was involved in the Coyome crash.
Interesting.
Yeah. And he even says he's always cautious of these sorts of things that just pop up. He was in Mexico City. He was doing an alien thing, and a guy shows up with a photograph of an alien saying that there was eyewitnesses. But for some reason, Dean's compelled to believe him. And the photograph's actually, it's actually pretty great.
Yeah, it is actually kind of like a really fairly decent photo.
Yeah.
It doesn't look too artsy. It looks real.
It looks like a photo that somebody snapped.
Right. It's very interesting. And they got it from source from that, from Atlanta.
He got it from a police officer in Mexico City when he was down there doing like an alien thing.
Interesting.
And Dean actually believes that it may be an alien that was involved in this crash.
Interesting. Well, I mean, again, we don't know much more about this incident. The beauty of this incident is all of the chess game that happened. America seeing this, Mexico losing their plane after it crossed the border, and then the jockeying to try to figure it out, Mexico sending somebody in, them stopping out of nowhere for no reason in the middle of nowhere, and America coming in, swooping in and cleaning the whole scene. It's crazy to think about like all of this, and none of us know about it.
None of us do. Well, you do now.
We do. You're now welcome. Thanks to, you know, some declassified information and then information provided by these people to the authors here, which is awesome, man.
Yeah, I gotta say, Mexico's Roswell, the Chihuahua UFO crash by Noah Torres and Ruben Uriarte is just fantastic. It's a fun book. You know, there's a lot of speculation in it. I get that, but what if?
Exactly. What if? And I mean, there's got to be documentation of these actual sightings and recordings of these things happening with the military. You know, radar data and stuff like that, whether it's been declassified or not, it's got to exist. Or does it? Is that the question?
Mm. And these two gentlemen actually went down to that area and started to look around. You know, what can they see? What's there? That sort of thing.
Right.
And they definitely did find parts of an aircraft, presumably the one that exploded.
Right.
So we know that much is true.
Interesting. Very interesting topic, though. I mean, like, we don't really hear about... When I first heard about this, there was a little thing on it. And I'm like, hey, we got to look more into this. And I'm glad that we did, because this is a very intriguing story. I mean, this is like the 70s version of, the Mexican Roswell.
It is the Mexican Roswell, yeah. It's steeped in conspiracy, too. And
absolutely. And total, like, just lots and lots of hearsay, conjecture. Again, I mean, it's speculation. But, I mean, the story, there's enough evidence there to say that this very well could have very well happened. And again, that road begins there in America, then in travels to Mexico, and then ends. The stopping would be the CDC in Atlanta, Georgia. Weird. Very weird. Very cool topic, dude.
Yeah, it was fun.
I'm very, very happy that we got a chance to dive deeper into this and let the people know about this incident. Because again, I wasn't aware of it until I saw this little thing on it. And yeah. now we know a lot about it.
It's super fun, and I just can only imagine, like, in the bowels of the CDC, in the top secret area, men suited up and women just tearing apart this craft.
Negative 30 level down in the basement, yeah, just, the basement of the basement of the basement of the CDC. Yeah, dude, just sitting there is this spaceship that we're
not sure if it contains reverse engineering. Some contagion.
Yeah, mm-hmm. Trying to figure out what exactly. They probably have already figured out what killed everybody at that scene at this point, if they do have it.
Yeah, so the theory is they didn't figure it out. They cleared it and sent it off to wherever these things end up going.
The sun.
Yeah, maybe the sun.
They end up on a rocket ship to the sun.
Oh.
That's how, Marvel, what S.H.I.E.L.D. takes care of their problems in the old Marvel universe. So
That's right.
Yeah, so that's my theory.
I like the Indiana Jones theory. They just put it in an unmarked crate and just throw it in a giant warehouse.
Yeah, Warehouse 54 or something like that. Yeah, absolutely.
Studio 54.
Exactly.
People are blowing lines off the aircraft.
Yeah, and that's where those things end up, in giant warehouses in Erie, Indiana.
Erie.
Erie, Pennsylvania? Is that what it is? Either way. All right, guys. Well, that was the Darker Side podcast for today. I am David Pottle. You can find me on Facebook and Twitter and all these other things. You can find the Darker Side podcast on, again, Facebook and all those. Check out the DCP Network and check out Getting Lost in the Forest, or GLITF, as Forrest likes to say. Forrest can be found on all these social medias that I just told you. He's got a bunch of cool projects going on. Please follow him. Herman, what do you got going on, bro?
Oh, not much. I'm on Instagram. Definitely check out the DCP stuff. Check out Forrest's podcast. He's passionate, and we missed him today.
We do. We love him. And everybody, have a wonderful time. And all I can say is one love, y'all. Welcome to the Darker Side.
So noisy. They don't like that. It sounds weird.
Choking on some creepypasta.
Yeah, no, it gets in your throat.